I like this kind of stuff.
Is this music? This was a real discussion back in the day, whether this was actually music or not. Do you think this is music, Hoff?
Yes, of course it is.
You like it?
Yeah? Like Yellow did later, many, many, many years later, used samples and made it into coherent, great-sounding music, especially if you listen to it more. Yes, it's music. And George Clinton comes to mind also with the use of samples. But I like this. And also the a bit of history about how this came about.
It's funny that you mentioned George Clinton. It's definitely in there. He was working at this time. He was working with Thomas Dolby, and they were having fun together also. That's maybe something for another episode. But yeah, definitely. And it's you know, this team of talented people that Trevor was building were doing all these sort of new and innovative things. It was just a very interesting time. So I just mentioned Paul Morley, Mr. Media, right?
Yeah.
Who by now was hugely successful with his propaganda strategy. For instance, for Frankie Goes to Hollywood, where he managed to create this whole sort of crisis with the BBC, where their single Relax was banned, which was obviously, you know, fantastic for the sales of the record. So he'd become a very important part of the team as well.
And great actually, marketing.
Yeah, definitely. He met a girl from Germany called Claudia Brücken, and she decided that she wanted to live over in London, and then the whole team decided that she would probably need a band of her own, And the name of her band was obvious. It would be Propaganda, right?
Yes.
being the wife of Paul Morley, it was sort of destiny. And Propaganda was formed around Claudia Brücken. And actually, they did something interesting. They tried to get a different producer for her to get a different sound. And they asked David Sylvian, the singer of Japan, to produce Propaganda.
Yes. Yeah.
And eventually he decided against producing them. But while he was thinking about it, he already came up with a couple of song ideas and the really ghostly top line and music of the song P Machinery. I'm a huge fan of Japan and David Sylvian. And the funny thing is, I never noticed it, but knowing this now, when I listen to P Machinery, I can sort of hear the relation. I can sort of hear his hand in it. It's very interesting. So let's listen to P Machinery for a minute.
I didn't know about David Sylvian's involvement, but I do know that I've been a big fan of Propaganda, and they didn't do much work. I believe it was one album and one compilation or remix album, but there's not one bad track on the album that they did. It was Blue with Grey, can't remember the name, and I did know that Trevor was behind it because it sounds big, just like almost everything that Trevor's involved in. What did you think that David Sylvian's influence was in this? What did you pick up on?
It's the you can definitely hear he's come up with the song, the vocals, the song structure, and you can also hear it in the sort of the rhythm of this track, which is slightly different from other tracks on the album, and it's actually reminiscent of the late work of Japan when they were very instrumentally focused as well. So yeah, I can hear that sort of signature in there. Yeah. But in the end, Stephen Lipson was the one who produced the Propaganda album, so he was another one of the people on the in the entourage of Trevor Horn. Obviously, Horn supervised the production. But making this album, again, they did something revolutionary. Mm-hmm. And they took a Lin, a Fairlight, a DMX, a DSX, and a Roland M5. And all of these were interconnected, and they were all programmed to be able to play the whole song. And then they synchronized the instruments with each other. So they programmed everything with the idea in mind that the girls could then sing over it while they would lean back and just press some buttons without using any tape. This was the dream, right? No tape.
Yeah.
They wanted to be able to do...
After doing 24 hours of work programming, they can sit back and let the girls
right.
sing.
And this was almost the inverse of the first song that we played, where they had these traditional instruments and they wanted to sound them, have them sound computerized. Mm-hmm. Here they were trying to get everything into the machine. And not only not use any instruments, but also not use any recording tape and, you know, have it all basically coming right out of the machines.
I like the way the voice sounds, by the way, the singer of Propaganda. What's her name again?
Oh, she has a beautiful, beautiful voice. Yeah, Claudia Brücken.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it takes you away.
Yeah, definitely. Obviously, they had this great idea of, you know, synchronizing all these machines and then using them this way. And on recording day, the whole setup went berserk. And they had to start all over again and eventually recorded the whole thing on tape.
Oh, man. Imagine if you were working on programming for 10 hours or so and then have a electrical surge or a problem so you can start all over again.
Yeah, they were trying to get these five machines synchronized and it was just too much, right?
Yeah.
But even though the fully programmed song technique failed the first time, Horn soon found out that it could be used to copy multi-tracks. And he could copy and paste them over several measures. And this is basically still the way in Pro Tools that music is being made today, right? And he thought, okay, wow, this is something I can use for Welcome to the Pleasure Dome. So that was supposed to be only a 3-minute intro track for Frankie Goes to Hollywood. But he was having so much fun copying and stretching all this music over and over that in the end, he worked 3 months on the song and it became 13 minutes long. That's how much fun they were having.
13 minutes, yeah. One of my favorites.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it?
Oh, that's almost a soundtrack to a certain era or something. Yeah. It's so big.
And you can hear all of the possibilities that were opening up once they had mastered this way of, you know, composing in the machine and then using all these sounds and being able to have all this freedom in moving all these sounds around and creating a great sound stage.
Yeah, I must also say that Trevor had a big ear, or his wife maybe along with him, for selecting great vocalists to sing, because Propaganda vocalist and also what's his name again, John something, from Frankie Goes to Hollywood.
Holly Johnson.
Yeah, Holly Johnson. That's his name. Yeah.
With this hugely talented group of people, they actually were the real stars behind many great 80s bands and acts. And they produced hits for, I'm going to take a deep breath here, Seal, Simple Minds, Frankie Goes to Hollywood, ABC, Mark Almond, The Art of Noise, Barry Manilow, Boyzone, Cher, Brian Ferry, Gabriel, Godly and Cream, Grace Jones, Paul McCartney, Tom Jones, Malcolm McLaren, Mike Oldfield, The Pet Shop Boys, Anne Pigalle, Spandau Ballet, Rod Stewart, Tina Turner, and Wendy and Lisa. All of those acts had their hits produced by this team of people.
Cher as well? Oh man, I didn't know.
And Dudley went on to become a producer for Tom Jones, Alison Moyet, and Debbie Harry. And then she also became the first composer for the BBC Concert Orchestra and an Oscar-winning soundtrack writer for The Full Monty, as well as having written over 23 other movie scores like American History X, Les Miserables, and Bright Young Things by Stephen Fry. Funnily, she also is the favorite soundtrack writer of Paul Verhoeven these days. She's done the scores for his movies Black Book, L, and his soon-to-be-released movie Benedetta.
I lost track of Paul Verhoeven, but he's coming out with some new stuff. That's awesome.
So yeah, there's a new movie, Benedetta, which is about a lesbian nun.
Really? It sounds like Paul Verhoeven.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. So Zwart Boek, Black Book was also, I think, a success.
I saw Paul walking in the streets of The Hague, which is a beautiful coastal city in the Netherlands, obviously, and Paul's living there these days. But I thought, is it him? And my wife said, yes, it's him. He lives around here. I didn't know, but I was too starstruck to approach him.
Yeah.
But holy shit, this guy. He was responsible for RoboCop, Showgirls. Yeah, I'm not sure why I'm saying Showgirls second, but also Total Recall, Zwart Boek, Soldier of Orange.
Flesh and Blood. Flesh and Blood. Definitely big movies. So that's fun to see that this girl that was picked up after college eventually, you know, was leading the BBC Concert Orchestra and winning Oscars. By the way, Hans Zimmer also has been making movie and video game soundtracks since the late 80s. He has a huge amount of Hollywood film scores to his name. You know, True Romance, Backdraft, Rain Man, Green Card, Gladiator, Black Hawk Down, 4 Batman movies, Pearl Harbor, Pirates of the Caribbean, Sherlock Holmes, Inception. And he won an Oscar as well for The Lion King in 2011.
Yes, that's a hard one. That's an animation.
Yeah.
Imagine if you can't relate to real life people but have to do it through an animation. That would be quite hard. Yeah. And I also read that the 3 or 4 Batman movies, it took him 12 years of continuous work and perfectioning and tuning it up to deliver it. And also, you are a big fan of this one, the Blade Runner 2049. He was doing the programming on that as well.
Yeah, definitely. And to lead up to this item, I mixed our previous episode. And in the previous episode of this podcast, The Happy Goth Accident, every backing track I used was actually taken from the Hans Zimmer Blade Runner 2049 soundtrack.
Now we gotta listen to it again.
Yeah, definitely. So you see this, how I made this comparison with Andy Warhol and his New York entourage. Trevor Horn created all these hits with this group of people who were all talented, who all ended up, you know, being rock stars or winning Oscars. And changing the face and the way the music was made all at the same time. So I think this is one of the least well-known and most influential people in the age of music that we like so much when the electronics started to get a whole new level of creativity out there.
Great background, Jeroen, and also great selection. And did you know what you just did there?
Oh.
You made a trifecta, buddy. It's a trifecta of greatness. It's a coherent 3 big tracks that we just played. So there you have it. Allow me to take it back to 1981, if that's okay, Jeroen.
Yeah, great year.
And let's listen to some music now, and I'll tell you a little bit about it afterwards. We're going to listen to The Sound with Sense of Purpose.
Thank you.
I'll try to not, you know, blather on about bass all the time, but the sound of the sound and the sound of the bass player in the sound is just awesome. It's just exactly the way I feel a bass guitar should sound. And when I was still playing in bands and recording, this is what I wanted it to sound like. So I love it. And also in this song, particularly in the chorus, in the second measure, it just, you know, lifts up the whole chorus, the way this bass line is being played. So I'm very happy with the song in general, and not just the bass, but it's so melodic and light and just right.
Not much to add there. It's energetic as well. And the reason I picked the sound, and it's quite honestly a miracle that we didn't pick up on the sound earlier in our podcast, because this has to be the most underrated band and underrated album that I know of in our beloved dark genre. Some bands racked up hit after hit and enjoyed fame and fortune in the 80s with post-punk stuff. Others never reached the top, but slowly built a following substantial enough to sustain a decade-long career. And then there are bands who get glowing reviews, but never have them translate into a large-scale public recognition. And they end up what's being called a poisoned label of being the critics' favorite. That's almost like a death sentence if you want to make it. You make great music, but you just don't have enough to cut it. And I don't know why, because one can only guess as to why the sound didn't make it into the big league. If you hear this song, and this whole album is fucking great, and the first one as well, the first two albums, and then okay, in all honesty, maybe you can skip it, but the first two are should be reason enough to have them break through. It is true that a lot of their songs sound a bit of the same, especially later on.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's not an issue for many bands, so why would it be an issue for them? And it couldn't have been the label, because they were on Warner, and Warner had, you know, enough money to promote them.
I'm totally guessing here. Your guess is as good as mine, Jeroen, but you're absolutely right.
Did you check video clips or something by them?
No, they don't have any, and I'm going to get to it, because maybe this is an example of video killed the radio star.
I was just thinking of that, right?
So they don't have any video clips apart from some live footage. But Adrian Borland, the lead singer, is very talented, but we cannot say it's a good-looking guy. He's short. He's a bit fat. it doesn't matter. But there are so many other great bands making other great music at that time. Maybe the sound just got lost in all greatness. Frontman Adrian Borland missed the charisma of Ian Curtis or Robert Smith at that time. And also in the age of video killed a radio star, Adrian wasn't the most handsome guy you would like to see in a music video. And also Adrian had a very severe psychological issue. He had a schizophrenic disorder, and he was an alcoholic on top of that, so he was not easy to work with. And an interesting fact is that this London-based band was more popular in the Netherlands than they were in the UK, and apparently we Dutchies have much better taste than our colleagues in the UK. Adrian also lived in the Netherlands for several...
Yeah, we just love us a couple of alcoholics.
Yeah, we do. And Adrian has also lived in the Netherlands for several periods in his life. Frustrated by the lack of success and the breakthrough that didn't come, the sound disbanded in 1987, sadly. And Borland, he just couldn't cope with the fact that other bands made it and not him. He was very, very dedicated and passionate about his music. And after the end of the sound, he started a solo career, kept writing songs and performing. And it's a crying shame that he took his own life in 1999 at the age of only 41. He jumped in front of a train at the Wimbledon railway station. There is a documentary about the life of Adrian Borland and the band The Sound, and it's called Walking in the Opposite Direction. It premiered at the International Documentary Festival of Amsterdam in 2016. We will post a link in our show notes. You can at least see the trailer. It's a paid documentary, but it's 1.5 hours long if you want to know more about Adrian and this wonderful band, The Sound.
I'm going to check that out. I really like the sound. I didn't know that they were not so big in other countries. Here in the Netherlands, the sound really were a name, right, in the 80s.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Yes, they were, and they were performing frequently, and you wouldn't have noticed. And now we have reached the final track for this week. It's called Under the Milky Way by The Church.
Sometimes when this place gets kind of empty, sound of their breath fades with the light. I think about the loveless fascination under the Milky Way tonight. Lower the curtain down in Memphis. Lower the curtain down, alright. I got no time for private consultation under the Milky Way tonight. Wish I knew what you were looking for. Might have
love this song so much. And this is one of these songs that I'd lost somehow. You know how you lose songs along the way and then you just never think of them again? And then somebody, you know, a friend plays it for you or brings it to your attention again and you go, oh, wow. And, you know, this whole sort of world of memories and loving this song and going, you know, back to the time that you heard it first, it all happens at the same time. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
But this is also just a very, very beautiful composition.
It is. Did you know they're Australian, these guys?
Really?
Yeah, I didn't know either. You can't hear it.
They must be the most sensitive Australians I've ever met.
Yeah. No accent, nothing. It's no. They are from Australia. No, and
subtle.
Yeah.
Subtle.
Very subtle, very subtle. Australians
that are subtle. Wow.
Exactly. But maybe it's because they recorded this album in Los Angeles. And I totally recognize what you're saying. You don't come across this song or album that much. I came across it recently when I watched Donnie Darko, another movie
right.
Link.
Oh, that so is an awesome movie.
If you want to look for movies, we covered so many great movies with soundtracks. And but they, in order to make this album, they temporarily moved to Los Angeles to record with producers Waddy Wachtel. I think that's a Belgian guy or something.
Must be.
He also produced for Bob Dylan, the Rolling Stones, Robbie Williams, more recently. Is that none? Not a
no.
small name. And also Greg Ladani, never heard of this guy, but he also produced Fleetwood Mac, among others. When they recorded this album in Los Angeles, it proved to be quite a challenge for the church. And according to the founding member, Steve Kilby, it was Australian hippies versus West Coast guys who knew the way they liked to do things. We were a bit more undisciplined than they would have liked. So personalities clashed, yes. Sounds a bit tense, right?
Sounds very rock and roll, man.
Yeah, personalities clashed as the two sides were debating over guitar sounds, song structures and work ethic. And under pressure from the producers, Kilby took vocal lessons as well, an experience he later regarded as valuable. And the stress of living in the US influenced their recording and left Kilby feeling out of place. And they put everything into recording Starfish. It sounds kind of stressful, while the album Starfish sounds quite relaxing to me, if I'm honest. 4 weeks of grueling rehearsals resulted in the album, which really skyrocketed them. They did 6 albums before this that you never heard of. Maybe you heard of Hey Day.
No.
And Hey Day was the album before this one.
No.
But they took 6 albums to get here. And apparently it took them a trip to LA and some frustration in order to get this greatness pressed into vinyl.
Yeah, isn't that funny though? Isn't that the way it works sometimes? That you think that, you know, for a band to record a great album, there should be, you know, love, peace and harmony. But sometimes under pressure, you know, the most special things happen.
True, in many working environments, but also in the studio, apparently. Yeah, and I'm not sure if you get this link as well, but if I listen to this one, do you know Love Will Tear Us Apart by Joy Division?
Yeah.
They seem to be made in the same space or something. They seem interlinked in one way or another. I can't see them separately. Maybe it's also because of Donnie Darko, because those both tracks are in that movie. But
it's a bit happier though, this version.
Yes. You're
but yeah, it's
a
definitely
right.
in the same spirit. And
I think we blew a lot of power in one episode, because if you listen to all these tracks, all these stories, everything that's behind it, there's a lot of power packed into a 1 hour podcast, if you ask me.
Yeah, I just hope we were able to tell people you know, something interesting and something new. You have this script, right, for the stuff that we do? Something old, something new, something borrowed, something blue.
Yeah, we
definitely
good
had
memory.
Some blue stuff.
Yes.
Yeah, we definitely had some old stuff. I think we may have tipped the scales towards the 80s this time. So we'll make up with some newer music in the next episode.
Sounds good.
Because we're not all old guys only listening to
music.
Let's
do so. That's a good
back,
challenge,
right?
By the way. Yeah.
But every now and then, we indulge. And I guess today we did just that. But You know, I thought it was a great show to do, a great show to make. I'm sorry for, you know, being a bit of a fanboy when talking about Trevor Horn and his entourage and all the stuff that they did. I just want to say thank you to everybody who's still listening.
There's just so much to say about Trevor. We could actually spread it across a whole season.
Yeah.
I thought it was quite compact.
Thank you. Yeah, there's much more to tell, but I think this was enough for one go, and I think I at least proved the point that he was this hugely influential guy with these mega talented people at the back of a lot of things that we loved back in the 80s. So, as I said, talking of spirits, hope that you are still listening here. If you did, thank you for making it through to the end. I hope you liked this episode. Please subscribe to our podcast so you can never miss another one. To subscribe, just go to our awesome website at theinfected.nl, and you can find the links to subscribe directly on Spotify, Google, or Apple Podcasts, or choose your poison. But also, we have some great Spotify playlists, mixed sets. We also have the show notes of each episode where you can reread the stories, and we offer all the relevant links and a couple of pictures here and there, and you can play the songs. Also, we regularly have exclusive interviews with artists. And basically, if you like this, subscribe and help us out with a nice rating on Spotify, Google, or iTunes.
Please do.
Thank you for now. Thank you for listening. It's been an honor and a lot of fun to make this episode together with you again, Gov. Thank you, too.
Likewise, Jeroen. Thanks, buddy.
Yeah. And so we come to an end. We thank you, our audience. And right now, in the spirit of the 80s, I'm going to get a bar of soap. I'm going to use it to make my hair look extremely 80s. And I think I'll take a quick stroll around the neighborhood while there's still some moonlight and see if I can shock a couple of neighbors. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Infect me.
It was a virus. Infection. You didn't need a doctor to tell you that. It was the blood. Or something in the blood. By the time they tried to evacuate the cities, it was already too late. The infection was everywhere. The army blockades were overrun. And that's when the extras started. The day before the TV and radio stopped broadcasting, there were reports of infection in Paris and New York. You didn't hear anything more after that.
What about the government? What are they doing?
There's no government.
Of course there's a government. There's always a government. They're in a bunker or a plane.
No, there's no government, no police, no army. No TV, no radio, no electricity. You're the first uninfected person we've seen in 6 days.